From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The White House is warning that COVID-19 could get worse in the U.S. in the months ahead. Here's White House Trade Advisor Peter Navarro speaking on CNN.
We are filling the stockpile in anticipation of a possible problem in the fall. We're doing everything we can beneath the surface, working as hard as we possibly can.
Meanwhile, nearly half of all states are currently seeing increases in cases. Several states had record increases over the weekend, including Florida and Texas. So far, about 120,000 people in the U.S. have died. Mercedes Carnathan is an epidemiologist and vice chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Northwestern University. She joins us now. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Well, and I know it's difficult to make sense of a lot of what's going on because there's a lot of data coming in and a lot we don't know. But from what you can see, give us the big picture here. What are you seeing in terms of the spread of new cases? And do you think that the spikes we're seeing are a result of businesses and public spaces reopening?
Yes. You know, the trends that we're seeing right now are what we anticipated would happen as we returned to circulating in society. The reason we closed down in March was really to prevent the rapid increase in cases that we had seen ever since COVID hit our shores. And what we're seeing now is that instead of the slow burn that we'd had for months, those states that have opened up and who have been open for the longest periods of time are seeing increases in the number of cases. And unfortunately, these patterns do follow what happened over in Asia and in Europe when states began their reopening plan.
Are you encouraged by the fact that many of the people who are getting sick now are younger, and we know that younger people in general don't die from COVID-19 at near the rate of people, let's say, over 60 or over 70?
Well, I'm never encouraged to hear that more people are becoming infected. However, I will certainly agree with the point that the likelihood that the outcomes will be good are certainly higher than when medically fragile or older adults contract disease. There are two reasons why we're seeing increases in the prevalence of young people contracting disease. The first reason is simply that young people are now eligible for testing. And so from that perspective, we are able to identify and actually count those young adults. The second reason that we see an increase in young people being diagnosed is that because younger adults are those who are quite often in the workforce, providing not only essential roles, but also staffing many different types of businesses, those individuals are out in the population more, thus increasing their likelihood of contracting COVID.
Well, when it comes to the issue of testing, as usual, we're getting mixed messages from the White House about this. Peter Navarro said that the White House is preparing for trouble in the fall. President Trump said at a rally that he actually wanted less testing. Here he was in Tulsa over the weekend.
When you do testing to that extent, you're going to find more people. You're going to find more cases. So I said to my people, slow the testing down, please.
Leaving aside all of the criticism of that statement, how much of the increase in cases we're seeing is actually just because of an increase in testing?
So that's a fallacy that many people struggle with, and they struggle with it because it is a little complicated. What we are not doing in our population is random testing. So if we were going out to a street with 100 people, knocking on doors and testing individuals, we would detect asymptomatic disease, people who didn't know they even had it. That type of testing would identify more cases, but that's not our current testing protocol. Because of still a limited number of test kits, we're testing people who present themselves to testing centers, and they present themselves to testing centers because they have symptoms or because they've come into contact with somebody who has the disease. So it would be incorrect to think that more testing is finding more disease, because this isn't hidden disease. This isn't asymptomatic or latent disease. This is disease secondary to symptoms, secondary to exposures. And so this increase is real.
Let me just ask you one more thing. We are less than 2 weeks away from the 4th of July, when many Americans will be celebrating together, if not at parades and fireworks displays, certainly at backyard barbecues and other kinds of gatherings. What would your advice be about how people can do that safely?
We have all been locked up for a very long period of time, trying to do our best to not circulate and spread COVID. We see these opportunities to get together with family and with friends who we haven't seen in a long time to be able to celebrate. The best way to do this safely is to still maintain physical distance and social distance to the extent possible. When that's not possible, to wear masks. The minor inconvenience of wearing that mask when it could protect you and it could protect your loved one should be a trade-off that we're willing to be able to make.
That is Mercedes Carnathan, an epidemiologist at Northwestern University. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
As early as today, President Trump could sign an executive order banning temporary work visas. It would be the latest effort by his administration to limit immigration as high unemployment continues to plague the country. And Democrats are calling for investigations into the firing of a U.S. attorney whose office had prosecuted Trump associates Michael Cohen and Rudy Giuliani. And for more, we're joined by NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. And Mara, there is a lot to dig into with Jeffrey Berman, the U.S. attorney Trump fired this weekend. Tell us what was his office in charge of and what reasons did the administration give for dismissing him?
Well, first of all, the administration doesn't really have to give a reason. He serves at the pleasure of the president, but the U.S. attorney in Manhattan has a certain amount of independence. But this is just the last in a long line of people that the president has removed who have had some role of investigating him or people close to him, whether it's the IGs in federal agencies, the FBI director, or now the U.S. attorney. And Jeffrey Berman, who was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, had control over some of the most significant white-collar crime cases in the country, and he was investigating or had investigated a lot of people close to the president. Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. He went to jail on charges of tax evasion. He indicted two of Rudy Giuliani's associates, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. He was also investigating Giuliani himself for possibly violating lobbying laws. So the list goes on. He was investigating a lot of people in the president's inner circle.
Yeah, it was very unclear who would replace Berman. What has the administration said about this, who they want to take the job now?
Well, for the moment, Berman is it was very confusing. A lot of names were floated. But right now, the deputy U.S. attorney is going to replace Berman on an acting basis. That is standard operating procedure. First, they tried to have somebody else replace him. Berman refused to step down, but then they reverted to standard operating procedure. However, the person that the administration wants to replace him permanently is Jay Clayton, who is now the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He's never been a prosecutor, but that is the person that they are going to nominate.
What else are lawmakers saying about this incident? Have any Republicans or Democrats called in joining for an investigation?
Well, the House Judiciary Committee is going to investigate. They think that Attorney General Barr had, quote, improper motives for removing Berman. They think this is political interference in cases that involve the president's associates. So the House Judiciary Committee is going to hold a hearing and probably call Berman to testify before that. In the Senate, we know that Lindsey Graham, who's head of the Judiciary Committee, is going to allow the senators from New York to block Jay Clayton. That's something called a blue slip. It's a tradition where individual senators can block the nomination of someone who comes from their home state. So that means that Chuck Schumer, who's the senator from New York and also happens to be the Senate Democratic leader, and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand could stop Clayton from getting confirmed by the Senate Judiciary Committee. And they already have indicated that that's what they're going to do. And Lindsey Graham, the Republican chairman of the committee, is going to let them.
A lot to watch out there for. Let's talk a little bit about the order halting these temporary work visas that the president is expected to sign. How much do we know about who this ban will impact and what people would still be allowed to work in the United States?
Okay, what we know is that this would continue a temporary ban on workers with a long list of visas, H-1B visas. Those are highly skilled workers who work often in the high-tech industry. L-1 visas, those are sometimes given to executives of high-tech companies. H-2B visas, those are people who come, they're seasonal workers, they work in hotels and restaurants. J-1 visas, those are temporary student visas, sometimes given to cultural workers or academics. This would not affect H-2A visas, that's agriculture workers or healthcare workers who are coming to work on the front lines of the COVID pandemic. So there are some exceptions, but this would continue the kinds of bans on immigrant visas that the president has already put into effect. He, in May, remember, he did a temporary halt to any new green cards.
Yes, a lot here to watch out for. We didn't even get a chance to talk about Tulsa over the weekend, but thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's NPR's congressional correspondent, Mara Liasson.
Thanks.
The 50-mile-long Panama Canal opened in 1914. It connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans so ships can cut across Panama rather than travel all the way around the southern tip of South America. The canal shortens the journey by about 8,000 miles. More than 100 years later, the canal still plays an important role in global trade. But the pandemic and climate change are threatening its business model. Joining us now on Skype as part of View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders, is Ricarte Vasquez. He is the administrator of the Panama Canal. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, and as the administrator of the Panama Canal, you have a front row seat to global trade. And I wonder, as we especially see the sort of complete drop off in air traffic in this country and around the world, what are you seeing right now? What is it like?
Well, we are seeing a very significant decline on shipping. For example, the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, which probably take most of the Asian imports into the United States, have shown drops of about 20 to 25%. Mm-hmm. As far as traffic through the Panama Canal, which was very robust for the first 3 months of this year, then thereafter, we have seen significant reductions in the volumes coming through the Panama Canal. Segments that have been hardest hit, of course, passenger vessels, which are cruise ships. You know, the whole industry have come to a halt. Vessels carrying automobiles, you know, supply chain has stopped in the early part of the year and now is slowing, reopening, but there is no demand. So even if you have production sites opening, you know, is there going to be a significant demand that is going to generate the volumes? So we are...
Well, so just give me an example of what you mean there. So in a typical day, let's go back to January before the shutdowns. How many ships would go through the canal versus today?
About 39 to 40 vessels a day. That was January. For example, today we had days of 25, 27.
Now, you're also dealing with another problem, which has been going on longer than the coronavirus pandemic and the trade war, which is climate change. 2019 was one of the driest years since the canal opened. There was 20% less rainfall than the average year. What does that mean for the Panama Canal?
We operate on fresh water. We are not a sea level canal. So we depend on rainfall. And we were at the lowest level to start a dry season probably in the last 20 years, 25 years. So we introduced two elements. We changed our operations so we can do something that is called cross-filling. In the old locks, which is called the Panama locks, then we transfer laterally water from one chamber to another. That requires that we schedule vessels in such a way that when one vessel was going south, the other vessel was going north, and they met at the lock at the same time. So scheduling was challenging. And the new lock, then we reduced the use of recirculating basins. And the risk of that is that you increase water salinity in the lake. So we have to produce a very specific balance between saving water with a lot less rainfall and then at the same time keeping water quality at a point which could be used for human consumption. We plan for the rainy season to begin in mid-May, and it did. So given that lower volume of traffic and the on-time start of the rainy season, our lake reached 82 feet of elevation last week, something that last year we accomplished by the end of September.
What about the fact that climate change is going to melt a lot of the ice in the Arctic, which is going to create a new shipping lane for people who want to get from one side of the world to the other? Are you worried about your competition coming from the Arctic?
Not as much, and I do not believe that is going to happen in the short term. Climate change is a very slow process. The Arctic route, compared to Panama, and this is one single element that I would love to point out. You know, when you come through the Panama Canal, you are dealing with the Panama Canal and the Republic of Panama. When you're going through the Arctic Circle, you are dealing with different countries, and it will take some effort for all of these countries to come to an agreement in how you use that route. The environmental situation that leads towards that route also brings along environmental concerns on the use of the route. I think that that is a major element in the years to come that we have to rely on, making sure that, yes, indeed, the Panama Canal is green, that is working towards zero emissions, that is environmental good citizen. I think that must come ahead of the curve in order to, you know, beat the competition in other areas.
Mr. Vasquez, the Panama Canal was opened in 1914. In 2020, how vital is it to the flow of goods around the world?
There have been a significant change over the last, say, 10 years of trade flows around the world. And probably some of that is a consequence of the financial crisis in 2009, approximately. Since then, the world has been trying to recover from that crisis. That being said, I think there is a tendency towards localization, which leads to an increased role in protectionism. That is Brexit, that is the U.S.-China trade war. There's a change in the North American free trade agreements. That is not a very significant trend at this time. But events like COVID then makes the whole criteria, the whole concept. So you will try to reduce long supply chains into shorter supply chains that are closer to the destination markets and introduce a lot less risk of any other event similar to what we are experiencing this year.
So what does that mean for the canal?
That means that global trade is going to be replaced to some degree by regional trade. When the canal was transferred in 1999, we were handling about 6% of global maritime trade. Now the patterns have shifted, and that share, market share, is down to about 3.5%. Now, there are new trades that are coming. A significant shift probably is going to be less manufactured products and more commodities. You know, foodstuff, wheat, crude oil, gasoline, all of that is going to become a larger component of the overall trade. For the U.S. market, the Panama Canal will remain very relevant. And as long as the U.S. economy is the largest economy of the world, we will have a very important role to play in world trade.
The United States used to control the Panama Canal. You mentioned that in 1999, it was turned over to the Panamanian government. What kind of a difference has that made to have control over the canal for the last 20 or so years?
This is a very small country that essentially location is what gears its value, its economic value around the world. So it's a very small open economy, which relies significantly and consequently at this time is going to go through very hard times on global markets. When we took control of the Panama Canal, One element that is different is that the Republic of Panama is not a user of the Panama Canal. When it was under U.S. administration, the U.S. was a user of the Panama Canal. And that is a significant difference in how the Panama Canal operates. Under U.S. administration, it was essentially a public service. It was a break-even entity. It was a break-even monopoly. So tolls and rates essentially reflected the cost of operation. Under Panamanian administration, the Constitution gave us a mandate to be profitable. So essentially, we went out and did our pricing and still do our pricing, trying to capture the economic value of the service. And by doing so, we are generating a major source of foreign exchange for the country.
That is Ricarte Vasquez, who is the administrator of the Panama Canal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for the interview.
So, is there a song about the Panama Canal? Well, of course there is, from the old cartoon Animaniacs. It actually does a pretty good job of explaining it.
Got a cargo of sodas, they are locale.
40 miles on the Panama Canal.
Sailing across the Caribbean Sea to the Pacific in a jiffy through Panama, but not on land. I'd look silly with my ship in the sand.
Yo, Hal, try the canal. Yo, Hal, the canal is your pal. You can sail a cargo ship from sea to shining sea through the Panama Canal for a nominal fee.
You enter a lock, it's a ship corral.
40 miles on the Panama Canal.
You pay your money, then get a decal.
40 miles on the Panama Canal.
You cross the locks, they number 3. Full of water for you and me. 100 feet wide, 41 feet deep. Water enough to drench a sheep.
High lock, up goes the ship. Low lock, the ship takes a dip. First they raise the water level, then lower it again. Cross the Panama Canal, it's really zen.
You know, I can recite all the states of the USA in alphabetical order because of a song I memorized from Animaniacs. And now we know all about the Panama Canal, too. Although they've been saying 40 miles, it's actually 50 miles long.
Our voyage is done from Colon now past Balboa. Adios, Panama, so long, aloha.
Tomorrow, Democrats in Kentucky will pick a candidate to challenge Republican Senator Mitch McConnell in November. Retired Marine fighter pilot Amy McGrath has raised tens of millions of dollars and was coasting to a likely win in the primary. But after recent protests over police violence, a black state representative named Charles Booker has seized the moment. Ryland Barton from Kentucky Public Radio reports.
Amy McGrath had a bumpy rollout to her campaign last July. She said in an interview that she would have voted to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court and then reversed her position within hours. And in interviews, she said things that came off as supportive of President Donald Trump, like on MSNBC when she accused Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of getting in the way of the president's agenda.
The message that the things that Kentuckians voted for Trump for are not being done. He's not able to get it done because of Senator McConnell.
McGrath's opponents have accused her of being a pro-Trump Democrat. In a recent online forum, she said her words are being twisted just because she would work to find common ground with the president.
Wouldn't you want that in a candidate? And I said specifically with regards to prescription drug prices that this current president has said was important to him. Wow, it's important to me too.
McGrath has an impressive resume as a retired Marine fighter pilot and foreign affairs advisor in Congress. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer courted her to run against McConnell, and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee endorsed her, helping her raise a staggering $41 million so far. But there are 9 other candidates in the race, and recent protests over racism and police violence have suddenly made 35-year-old State Representative Charles Booker a much more familiar name to voters.
We are your family, too! When you take that suit off, you're my family, too!
Here's Booker at a Black Lives Matter rally earlier this month, talking about police who had been clashing with protesters.
And understand, instead of being adversarial, instead of being confrontational and lining up like you're ready to beat us over the head, lock arms with us, demand accountability from even your colleagues and law enforcement, demand justice with us!
Louisville has become one of the focal points of the national protest movement because of Breonna Taylor, a 26-year-old emergency room worker who was shot to death by police serving a no-knock warrant at her apartment in March. And Booker has been present at the protests. He's been tear-gassed, he's been giving speeches, and at times he's been acting as a liaison with city leaders. And McGrath hasn't.
We're in the middle of a pandemic, so we also have to look at, you know, is that the place to be right now?
Booker's recent surge helped him raise $2.4 million since the beginning of June, three times the amount he had raised the entire campaign so far. He's also landed endorsements from state party leaders, as well as Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But the question is whether Booker has the momentum to overcome McGrath, especially because Kentucky expanded mail-in voting and many people cast their ballots early. Al Cross is a longtime political journalist in Kentucky. He says it's possible, especially because Black Lives Matter demonstrations that have taken place in small towns across the state.
There is a substantial vote out there among white folks who think black folks deserve a better deal. And Booker is the candidate of those people.
The winner of tomorrow's primary will still have an uphill battle in Kentucky, where President Trump still remains extremely popular. Mitch McConnell has hitched himself to the president, and though the senator's approval rating is underwater in the state, it was in 2014 as well. He ended up winning that race by 15 points. For Here and Now, I'm Ryland Barton in Louisville.
Author Mitch Albom is best known for his best-selling work, Tuesdays with Morrie and The Five People You Meet in Heaven, books that explore what it means to be human. He's also one of the reasons I'm a journalist, but we'll get to that later. Now, in the midst of COVID-19, Albom is releasing a new book, chapter by chapter, that he's writing in real time called Human Touch. It's free to read, and at the end, Albom encourages people to donate to his charity, Say Detroit, which will help in the city's fight against COVID-19. For more on his project, award-winning author and philanthropist Mitch Albom joins me now via Skype. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Tanya. Nice to talk to you.
Yes, so this new novel, Human Touch, tells the story of four Michigan families that live on the same street as the country experiences coronavirus. What inspired you to write this novel in real time?
Well, I knew early on, because of the charities I operate here in Detroit, that we were going to get hit pretty hard by COVID-19. That we're set up in the worst case scenarios, a lot of intergenerational housing, a lot of people close together, a lot of people with hypertension and diabetes and pre-existing conditions. So I said, well, what can I do to help my city and raise some money? And the thought that came to me was, well, what I do is write books. I mean, that's probably, you know, people know me best for. Maybe there was a way to write one and just take the money and give it to the city. And the fastest way to do that is doing something online. So from the time I thought of the idea to the time I had committed to the idea to the time I was writing the first chapter was a week. And I had to come up with a story that could be flexible enough that I could keep creating it every week. And then just encourage people. I didn't want to charge for it because I just thought even if you charge $2, there might be people who didn't have that at this time. So I just wanted to give encouragement to people to make donations to help us fight COVID-19. And took a chance on it. And it seems to be working okay.
Let's talk a little bit about the storyline. So it includes the rise of a militia targeting Chinese Americans, and specifically the character Sam Lee. Tell us how you came to this idea of telling the story through four very different families.
Well, when you're going to create a story in real time and you're only going to stay a week ahead of publication, you need flexibility. And so I knew if I'd created a neighborhood and one street corner, because I thought that was sort of symbolic of how we were all kind of living apart yet living together. And there were four houses on this street corner and four families in the houses. So I created a doctor because I thought, well, that's going to be important. And the doctor's family. I had a pastor because I thought, well, faith and gathering for faith is going to be an interesting issue. Chinese American couple, as you point out, because especially at the time when I started, there was a lot of finger pointing, blaming and scapegoating of Chinese Americans. And a business owner and an older guy who owns a cider mill. And then I introduced an 8-year-old Haitian boy, which I'm happy
Moses.
To tell you. Little Moses, who has become the star of the book. And there's quite an interesting backstory on him. But together they were all living on this corner. And then I could just watch as coronavirus started to affect relationships, how these people who always had these tradition of Saturday get-togethers at each other's houses, it was just something they always did. They all ate the same food and they hugged and they played. Now, all of a sudden, they slowly had to separate and people became distrustful of one another and somebody got the disease in one family and they were concerned about getting it elsewhere. And this was really what was playing out in the streets around me.
Hmm. You mentioned Moses, this young Haitian boy that readers will discover is perhaps the miracle that many feel is needed right now. Without giving away spoilers for this, for those who haven't read it yet, what's the role of the miracle in this book? Is it Moses or is it the human touch?
Well, it's a little bit of both. The backstory I mentioned is I operate an orphanage in Haiti, and we have 52 children that we raise. We don't adopt any kids out. We raise them. And one of them, an 8-year-old boy named Knox, I happened to bring up here for a therapy session on his leg. And he came up on March 1st. And as you can imagine, there wasn't any going back. And so he has lived with us ever since. And he has been the absolute joy of our existence. He's always upbeat and funny and curious, and he's just having the time of life here. And my wife and I realized it's his being able to hold him and hug him and play with him has made this tolerable for us in what's otherwise we're locked inside. Children really can be a way out of this. And so I created a character, 8-year-old Haitian boy who's got circumstances that brought him up here, who is immune to all of the disease. You know, I won't give away how, but he just can't catch anything. And so eventually, as people start sequestering and secluding in their homes, he goes from house to house, kind of sneaks around, opens back doors, sneaks through windows, and goes to the people who are sick and lets them hold him, you know, hug him or play with him or hold his hand.
Yeah.
And he provides that human contact that we so long for, just as Knox has provided it.
What a connection, and connecting it to your personal life and really what healing looks like and having young people around, and then perhaps this idea of touch within this novel. Can you tell us more about where the funds are going and how much you all have raised so far?
We created a subset of our charities, operate a charity called Say Detroit, and we created a subset called Detroit Beats COVID-19 and dedicated all the funds from Human Touch to go to that. And we laid out 6 key areas that we were going to help in, from senior citizens, or 2,000 senior citizens who we didn't want going out and having to go shopping. So we've been feeding them three meals a day ever since we started the project. PPEs for first responders and masks, things like that, food products, a homeless center with the Detroit Rescue Mission for homeless people who have gotten COVID-19, and they obviously still need a place to go. And so it's a quarantine center that we've helped operate, several other operations. And then the big one was testing centers, because here in Detroit, we only had one really big testing center, and you had to drive to it, and it was in the northern part of the city. So we realized from working in the city, a lot of people that don't have cars, and a lot of people can't get up there. So we opened the first walk-up test site for COVID-19 testing, and we've been operating these test sites ever since. And that's been our biggest focus. And honestly, Tanya, it's, you know, people are always looking for good news. I put this story up week at a time with no requirement to make any donation whatsoever. And through that, we've already raised well over $600,000. And it's just so interesting that you do something for free from your basement, essentially, and you can help affect the world in a weird way. And it's a message I always try to get through in my books.
You know, I want to tell you something, Mitch. I started reading your Sunday sports columns in the Detroit Free Press when I was 11. My grandfather brought me a Brother word processor, and I'd take your Sunday column and then rewrite them on that processor. And I'd also write you, and you actually would write me back on that beautiful Free Press letterhead typed out. You know, those were the times we were in. It goes to show it's really the small things. It really speaks to how these small moments really make up our humanity and really have big impacts. I mean, I'm a journalist now, and that's in big part to you.
Well, there's part of me that's tempted to say, don't blame me. But the other part is very, very flattered and honored. And I always tried to answer people who have written me, especially younger people over the years, because I too was influenced by someone when I was younger. thank you for saying that. And I'm glad. It just shows that whole, you know, connectivity, which is something I've been writing about since the Five People You Meet in Heaven. I mean, or even Tuesdays with Maury. One person, touches another and another and another. And we have no way of ever knowing the ripples in the pond that we create by the pebbles mm-hmm. that we throw. But we're doing it now. And Knox is doing it here. You know, a little girl named Chica, who we adopted from our orphanage, became the subject of my most recent book that wasn't online, Finding Chica, the story of this little orphan girl who was born 3 days before the earthquake. And I had no idea how a child who was born in another country and other different circumstances could affect my life so profoundly. And yet she made my wife and me and her a family. And so it doesn't stop this whole human touch connection thing. And I'm glad you just evidenced it with your story.
Thank you so much, Mitch. And thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
COVID-19 isn't gone. The sun's out, but it's not gone. And we're still fighting it here. So I hope we can continue. And I thank you for giving me a few moments to talk about it.
That's Mitch Albom, award-winning writer, philanthropist, and author of the free online book, Human Touch.
Many of the new cases of COVID-19 across the country appear to be in young people. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said the majority of new cases there are in people under 30. In California, nearly half of recent cases are in people under 35. That could explain why there have been fewer deaths even as cases rise. Last week, for example, CDC statistics show people under 45 accounted for only about 3% of the total COVID deaths in the U.S. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Bill Maher on HBO addressed the issue of millennials and COVID-19 over the weekend. Take a listen to this.
We need someone to lead us back to a life not dominated by fear. And millennials, you have just the immune systems to do it. You know, the greatest generation wasn't great before World War II. The war made them great because they rose to the challenge. This is your challenge. And I'm not asking you to storm the beaches at Normandy. Just storm the beaches and the stores.
Now, Maher said he was not talking to young adults who have health problems or to those who spend time with older people. But Derek, could it be that the spike we're seeing now will be easier on people and the healthcare system than the one a couple months ago because it's younger people with probably healthier immune systems?
It's a great question. It's a really important question because you look at some of these top line statistics and it looks like American COVID cases are accelerating again. But the three states with the most dramatic rise in cases are Texas, Arizona, and Florida. And in each of those three states, you do see that the new crop of people who are getting sick, the new crop that are officially infected by COVID, tend to be younger. In Texas, as you said, the state officials are saying that it's young adults who are driving the spike. In Arizona, COVID cases are growing 2 times faster among people under 45 than among people over 65. And then in Florida, this might be the most incredible statistic to back up the case that it's young people driving this. The median age of new COVID cases has fallen from 65 in March to 35 this week. Now, this all might be an artifact of changing testing methodologies. It might be that we're testing older sick people in nursing homes less and testing the general population more. But since the positivity rate, the share of these tests that are coming up positive, is also increasing, it does suggest that this is real, that the kind of people who are getting sick right now do tend to be younger. And younger people, as we know, are less likely to die from COVID-related causes. So that's why the case-death gap, as you said, might be increasing. But this doesn't mean that we should simply, you know, wash our hands with it and say, you know, young people should storm the beaches, they should go into the restaurants and bars and live a normal life. This is still a very, very dangerous disease. And I hope that we don't allow ourselves to simply forget about it just because we've been living with it for a long time.
Well, yeah, look, you and I are both in our 30s. And I know just from my point of view, I have been very careful when it comes to COVID-19, and maybe I'm too far in that direction. But is the reason that more younger people are getting infected because they're not being careful enough, that millennials are feeling it is not so risky to go out to restaurants and bars that have been allowed to reopen.
I think it's a totally plausible interpretation. I think that a story that you could tell that for now matches up with the data that we can see is that young people got one message and older people got kind of the same message, that people are learning that this disease is orders of magnitude more dangerous for those who are over 65, over 80 in particular, than it is for people that are under 25. And so you have a lot of younger people who are saying, well, if this is only, whatever, 5 times, 10 times worse than influenza, then I'm just going to basically go about my daily life. Whereas older people saying this is essentially a quasi-death sentence if you get it and you have a severe health complication over the age of 80 or 90, that they're staying inside. That's totally possible. At the same time, I think it's important to reiterate that even if it's better that you see accelerating cases among a lower risk group, that doesn't mean that it's good, right? Good means you don't see nationally accelerating cases, because this is still a very, very dangerous disease. And young people can, of course, spread the disease to their older, more vulnerable relatives.
Okay, let's just finally, in the minute we have left here, go from Gen Y to Gen Z and what happened over the weekend at President Trump's rally in Tulsa. It sounds like a bunch of Gen Z people organized a prank. K-pop stans and TikTok fans, and they got a bunch of tickets for the event and then didn't go. What happened?
Right. I mean, the big news from this morning is that President Trump is extremely upset at how few people showed up for his Tulsa rally. And the reason that he was disappointed is that you appear to have had hundreds of thousands of online activists and pranksters registering for tickets via TikTok or through K-pop or Korean pop music groups online. So it's not so much that these young people, Gen Z, stole scarce tickets. It's more that they raised the expectations of the Trump team for the crowd that he was going to see. They might have been expecting something on the order of a million people to show up. Well, a million people did not show up. In fact, the stadium was partially filled as it might have been for a mid-level professional hockey game. And that is why the president is so upset this morning.
Well, so they didn't show up. We'll see if they show up to vote. Derek Thompson, Indeed. Senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.